How do U.S. students fare when compared with other students from other countries? We're going to talk about that right now with Dr. Matthew Meehan, who teaches at Hillsdale College in the D.C. campus. He's the director of academic programs there. And this is Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb. Dr. Meehan, it's great to have you on the program. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I understand there was a recent study that, and these things come out every year, I guess, but it compared about 60 different countries and how the students are doing, and the U.S. students are not really doing that great, even compared with other countries, for example, in math, in reading, and in science. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the study that came out is you have to wait every 3 years to see how the performance of students compare, and it's the Program of International Student Assessment, or PISA, and it's really a leaning tower these days, for sure. And what happened was our scores in science, mathematics, and reading were all sort of flatlining, like a mild uptick in science, but more of kind of a statistical burp than anything exciting or positive. But some people were touting it as a success because we'd actually gone up in the rankings. But if you actually pay attention to the actual net values of what we know, essentially we've gone up in the rankings because other people have failed, but a lot of competitor countries have gone way ahead of us. So we're actually sort of flatlining for the last decade almost, and that's after a precipitous number of drops over the years. And now we're sort of stagnating in a place where a lot of competitor nations are flying forward and higher than us. And that's with enormous increases in spending, the whole Common Core overhaul, and much ballyhooed promise of really getting especially our public educational institutions much improved.
Yeah, why is that? I mean, this happens over and over. And by the way, I personally, and I'm coming, this is a Christian station, I'm coming from a Christian perspective and so forth, but the old statement in the Bible is so true, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. I was just at lunch a couple of hours ago, and this fellow was explaining how he, you know, he was talking about his academic record as far as college, and how he basically didn't finish college, but then after he had a major conversion, later he did see the need for it, and he did finish college, and he's done really well since. And, you know, and I've seen that. The founder of this station dropped out of the University of Tampa with C's and then became born again and later went to back to school and ended up getting all A's and went on to get a PhD at New York University. There's something to be said for the God factor in education.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing, right, that when you're filled with the grace of God, you start to want to know about God's creation, you know.
Yeah.
Interesting, right? Yeah, so that it's. I think that's right. What you've basically put your finger on is that irreligious sort of overtones can kind of stymie or kill the studiousness of a given people, and I think you definitely see that. Now, the problem with making that argument is that there really are a lot of naysayers. Right. Obviously, you've got basic secular culture, the bad kind of secular, to the exclusion of God, that doesn't want to hear that kind of argument. Says, "Oh, there's no proof of that." But you even have Christians saying, "Like, no, that's not a real thing, because you know you can't connect the dots in some sort of easy social science demonstrable way." But there's lots of chains of causes that are harder to track with social science methodology that may still be very real, and I think this is one of them. And you know, we could talk about that, the long story short, as you put it, from a biblical perspective, is just so. But it is worth kind of going through, and we can, some of the natural processes by which what happens when you remove God from the long-term horizon of these students.
Well, at one time, America was probably the best educated country in the world. I mean, for example, in the early, let's say the 1600s, say about 1700, my goodness, so many of the original colonists, these are the people who founded Harvard, Puritans, and these are the people who founded Yale and so forth. And they were very studious, but now we don't rank first here, and you know, we rank 11th, for example, in science, versus, but we were 17th, I guess, in 2015. So like you said, there was a bump. But give us an overview. Why are we doing badly, and who's doing better than us?
Well, so why we're doing badly, I think I would point to two different things, and one we sort of began to talk about. But the 20th century saw a series of attacks on the ability to speak about God, to raise the horizons and sights of children in schools to God. You've got McCollum versus the Board of Education, District 71 in 1948. You've got...
Oh, okay, what was that? What was... Wait, tell us about McCollum. What was significant about that?
So, essentially, people were offering religious instruction in public schools, and essentially, they were on their property using the classrooms, and the students could get out of a kind of, like, sort of stand-in ethics class if they went and took their catechism or their Bible study or their religious formation. And that was common practice, is that the various religious groups would come in and supplement with religious ed, because that understanding of piety and virtue was a no-brainer as part of a healthy education, and part of the sort of the engine and modus for the rest. And that was essentially deemed to be, you know, an establishment of religion, even though it wasn't one or, you know, the other was being, well, there was one religion that was doing it at the time, but rather than ask for inclusion, they just threw the whole thing out. And usually, you know, and that's a kind of, that was a big change. A really big change from the way the public schools and public education had been conceived in the country since, as you mentioned, since the 1600s.
And you were starting to mention other decisions along the same line.
Each of them, well, you know, the big one, 1962, was Engel versus Vitale or Vital, which is the that's the one where you the school cannot offer a prayer. So then it was like students could offer a prayer, but that got interpreted that the students can't even have a moment set up in the day for prayer. So there's no public ability to honor God, even in a kind of, you think of, you know, George Washington's Thanksgiving Day proclamation, where it's, you know, the Congress is like, we should honor God and be grateful and thankful. And that's what people don't understand, is when you remove God, you get two things. You lose a sense of gratitude, and that actually removes a lot of the motive force of being duty-bound to know what creation is and know how to steward it. But there's a whole other set of atrophy going on here, which is on the natural side of things, which is the basic educational understanding of what liberal arts curricula are for. Mm-hmm. What does liberal arts mean? That tradition is very old, and has always been sort of wrapped up in the Christian community since, you know, since Christ first said, "Be wise as serpents, innocent as doves," right? Mm-hmm. Matthew 10:16. You've got to learn the world's things so that you can bring it to the service of God. But the liberal arts is the other thing that's atrophied, which is people think it's sort of reading, writing, arithmetic. It's so you can get a job. It's, you know, at best, it's like, well, I want you to be able to write a good memo or something. Maybe you get something like communication skills. There's all these very low bar or low goals for the liberal arts. But I like to retranslate the old traditional phrase, artes liberales. The liberal arts is what we do it in English. That's how we talk about it. But you can translate it this way. It's the arts of liberty. Like, it's literally the practices that help you be free. And the original charter of the liberal arts, back from, we're talking Roman Republican Empire, like when it was first being built up, how to do grammar, logic, rhetoric, science, and arithmetic, geometry, the whole nine yards. When it was first being ramped up, it's like, this is a preparation for virtue, right? That's what this is for. So that's been completely lost, is the idea that you're not just learning how to communicate, you're learning how the reason why you learn communication or rhetoric, the art of persuasion, is so that you can be a good friend, so that you can bring justice about in your city, so that you can persuade people to the truth instead of using force, bullying, propaganda, fear, Twitter mobs, etc. There's all of these instruments, these arts that we can use for virtue. They don't make you automatically virtuous, but they're like the kindling for the fire of virtue. So it's a kind of a two-pronged, both the sort of the natural side of education has lost its way, and we've lost the vision of the more exalted vision of God. And the last part of the combination of these two is when you make any mention of God or prayer or piety in school a problem, the fact is religion is so wrapped up with the formation of virtue that what you wind up doing is anything to do with virtue talk gets called Jesus talk and gets thrown out of the public schools. So you get this evisceration of even the natural liberal arts. So supposing you were some noble pagan and not Christian at all, and you just wanted to teach the liberal arts, well, if you start talking about the virtue of justice and the virtue of temperance, people go, whoa, that sounds like something from the Bible. You better lay off that, buddy. So even if you wanted to be sort of strictly secular in the liberal arts, when you pull God out, you actually wind up throwing out even moral formation of a more humane or just even secular character. So it's a pretty nasty cocktail we've mixed for poor kids in school.
So really, in effect, political correctness has a stranglehold on American education, at least in the public sphere. And until that stranglehold is broken, we should probably expect these kind of mediocre numbers of test scores.
I think that's right, and I think they need to be persuaded to feel some shame, even on their own ground, because they're not necessarily going to feel shame that they're not embracing Christ, right, or whatever, whatever the religion of the community is that wants God in the schools, because even natural piety of whatever sort is better than none. But they're not going to feel shame on that. But you can make them feel ashamed even on their own grounds. Right, you don't understand even natural education and its virtue formation, because you keep throwing virtue out, trying to keep Jesus out of the schools. Mm. So you can, they're failing on their own merits. Never mind the more excellent merits that we're talking about.
Hmm. By the way, earlier you mentioned George Washington and his Thanksgiving Proclamation. I happen to know the date of that. It's October 3, 1789. The significance, or one significant factor of that, is it was Congress itself which
told him to do it,
and this is the very same Congress that gave us the First Amendment, which today is being misinterpreted as to say, oh, strict separation of church and state, by which they really mean the separation of God and state, which the founders would never have agreed. There's a new movie out called No Safe Spaces, and Dennis Prager, who, by the way, said recently in an interview, and I know because I'm the one who did the interview with him, he said, look, in the 60s, they threw out school prayer, and the kids were praying for their teachers. He said within a generation, the kids were cursing their teachers in the same schools because of that change.
Yeah, no, we're meant to be ruling ourselves, right? But on behalf of God, our ruler. And when you throw that out, you have neither. You can't rule yourself, and you're not ruled. So self-government requires piety.
Exactly. Okay, we have 30 seconds. I'll give you a website, dc.hillsdale.edu. If you were an advisor to Betsy DeVos, and this is more than a 30-second question, what would you say in light of this recent study?
I would say she's doing the right thing by pointing to school choice and charter schools that are leading the way back to the freedom to talk about virtue and God in a variety of new settings. I think the public school system either needs to let God back in the door or let go of all the kids.
Mm, wow. Dr. Matthew Meehan of Hillsdale in D.C., thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.